From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Sopranos ends its 8-year run Sunday night on HBO. Will Tony get whacked? Well, we don't know. But we're going to look back at the formation of television's most famous mob family. We hear from David Chase, who created the show. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Ocean's 13. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. After 8 years, a handful of lengthy absences, and who knows how many mob hits, pasta plates, and topless bada bing dancers, The Sopranos is calling it quits. This Sunday, the groundbreaking, TV-changing HBO drama series presents its long-awaited final episode. We'll finally find out whether Tony Soprano, played by James Gandolfini, A, gets whacked, B, whacks the head of the New York mob, C, takes his family and retreats into the witness protection program, or D, does something else which springs from the fertile and unpredictable mind of series creator David Chase. On today's show, to commemorate the passing of The Sopranos, we'll replay Terry's 2000 interview with David Chase. Let's start with a scene from an early episode. Tony is sitting in the kitchen with the lights off, a little preoccupied and more than a little drunk, when his teenage daughter Meadow, played by Jamie Lynn Sigler, walks in and surprises him.
Why are you sitting in the dark?
I don't know. Light the dark. Sit.
I gotta go online.
Oh, come on. Sit for a minute. Come on. So what's going on?
With what?
Whatever, I don't know. What's going on?
I just told you. The chat room. Is that it?
You know I love you, right, man?
Dad.
No, don't dad me. Come on. I want to know. Do you know that I love you?
Yes. I know that you love me.
Well, your mother doesn't think I love you enough.
Can you listen to her?
Everything I do, and everything I've done, and everything I will do, it's all for you and your buddy, you know that?
I think you should go to bed.
I mean, I tell people, you're like your mother, but you're all me. Nothing gets by you. And I know you think I'm a hypocrite.
I'm going to bed.
Yeah, all right, go ahead.
Dad, why don't you go to bed?
No, I'm gonna finish my drink.
Okay. Can I?
Good night, baby.
Well, you're so lucky to have found in James Gandolfini someone who has such an interesting face to watch, and his face is kind of mercurial. I mean, although I'm sure he's trying not to betray what he's thinking, you can see what he's thinking on his face. And sometimes he looks very weak and vulnerable, and sometimes he's incredibly cold-blooded looking. How did you find him?
Well...
Oh, and let me ask you one thing, too, in terms of looking for him. You've cast at the center of the series someone who is a very charismatic actor, but he's not a leading man kind of looking actor. He's got a pot belly, receding hairline, pudgy face. It's not Al Pacino.
No. I always go for the actor. If the actor who came in to read for this part had been Cary Grant and it had worked, I probably would have said, fine, let's do that. But we didn't. What really we were blessed enough to have happen is that James Gandolfini came through our door. And I honestly mean this. This is, you know, there's without Jim Gandolfini, there is no Sopranos. There's no Tony Soprano. That's why the whole thing, I think, is so identifiable to so many people, because he just is so human. And people respond to him. Their hearts and their heads go out to him, despite the heinous things he's doing on screen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he comes off as the regular Joe, you know. But I think what's going on there is you have a very, very extremely emotional person and sensitive person. And that's what Tony Soprano has become as a result of him.
Edie Falco plays the role of Carmela. What did you tell Edie Falco about the character of Carmela after you cast her?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Just comes in, does her work.
Was Carmela...
No direction, honest to God. No direction, no nothing. The case with most of these actors. There's very little directing going on.
When you wrote the character of Carmela, Tony's wife, did you base it on any of the people who you knew from the old neighborhood where you grew up? Because you grew up in the same township that The Sopranos is set in.
Right. Right. But when you say the old neighborhood, I think people probably get the idea of sort of like stoops and three-story, you know, brownstone houses. I grew up in the suburbs, mm-hmm. And that's where The Sopranos takes place. Were there people in my town like that? I guess, actually, when I think about it, I think she reminds me somewhat of some of my cousins.
In what way?
Very direct. They'll tell you exactly what's on their mind. My cousin Diana was a lot. Now, I'm thinking about this for the first time. You asked me this. I've never thought about this before. I had a cousin, Diana Spizzato, who was much older than me, actually. She was a contemporary of my mother. But she was my cousin. She was my first cousin. And she had this kind of... she was tough, and she had this kind of world-weariness about her. At the same time, she was a great mother and extremely capable, sharp woman. But you could not push her. And, you know, if you did, you'd hear about it. She'd come back at you.
Well, here's a scene between Carmela and Tony from The Sopranos.
I hope you apologize to him.
For what?
Tony, you promised him you were going to be at his swim meet.
Oh, I forgot.
How could you forget?
Something I had to do.
Tony, he almost came in second. You should have seen his face when you weren't there.
Yeah, well, I saw his face the other day when he had to go to the mall when I wanted to take him to the movies.
What are you, 6 years old?
Yeah, I said I'd try to be there.
What is with you, Tony? This whole week, you're like an alien life form among us.
There's nothing wrong.
Thank you for sharing.
You know what? Leave me the alone. I'm exhausted. I'll make it up to him the swim meet.
So where were you? Did you go see Christopher at the hospital?
Yeah, I went to see Christopher at the hospital.
Wherever you were, it couldn't have been more important than letting your son know that you care about him.
No, only you care. You.
No, you!
What's wrong with you?
My guest is David Chase, and he's the creator and executive producer of The Sopranos. It seems to me that The Sopranos started off with a little bit more comedy and that it's become just more tragic for the characters as time goes on.
I know. People have said that, and I didn't realize that. I don't see it that way. So it's
you don't
very
see
difficult.
It that way? Uh-huh.
I don't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The last show, we did a sudden U-turn. If that's what people are talking about.
The last show of the second season.
Mm-hmm. The last show of the second season. In that, there was a plan. We had a plan for Tony's emotional growth or lack of growth throughout the first season. The idea carried over from the first season was, okay, based on what we seem to remember about therapy or know about therapy, if you compress it all, and of course it takes much longer than this, and it's... You get to a point, my parents did this, my parents did that, you're slamming your parents, the shrink is saying, oh, those parents you had, what do you expect? You can't be any better than you are. And you go through that, and then you get to a point where it's okay, so your parents were your parents, now what are you going to do? You know, you're going to, as a shrink once said to me, what would you like to do? Should we have an auto da fe and burn the old lady at the stake? And she's your mother, what can you do about it? And so we got to that point in the show, and the second season was about Tony realizing that people kept saying to him he was his own worst enemy, that the seeds of his own destruction and his problems were internal, as they are with all of us, really. In the end, you're here and there's no excuses for who you are. The kind of a U-turn that we took rather suddenly was as we were doing show 13, I suddenly, something in me kind of snapped, and I got tired of some of the moralizing that some of the characters were doing. And I began to feel that Tony Soprano is a gangster, he is a mobster, end of story. And that's enough said about him as regards his quote-unquote internal development for now. And so in the end, the feeling that I got from the last show was that, and I thought it was also necessary to remind the audience, this is a mobster, this is a gangster. You may think he's lovable. He's also a very, very scary man.
Let's hear a scene between Tony and his psychiatrist, Dr. Melfi, from about three episodes from the end of last season. And this gets a little bit to what you're talking about. This conversation isn't about Tony's mother. It's about who Tony is and the kind of problems he's responsible for of his own volition in the work that he's doing and in the crimes that he's committing. So here's Tony with Dr. Melfi.
Do you know why a shark keeps moving?
They gotta keep moving or they'll die. They can't breathe or something.
There's a psychological condition known as alixithymia, common in certain personalities. The individual craves almost ceaseless action, which enables them to avoid acknowledging the abhorrent things they do.
Abhorrent? What certain personalities?
Antisocial personalities.
My future brother-in-law. Ran over a guy, no reason. Guy's paralyzed. Has to piss into a cathode tube. What happens when these antisocial personalities aren't distracted from the horrible they do?
They have time to think about their behavior, how what they do affects other people, about feelings of emptiness and self-loathing haunting them since childhood. And they crash.
The scene from The Sopranos, my guest is the creator and executive producer of the series, David Chase. Where does that scene take us in the development of Tony?
Well, it was intended to be building toward some sort of conclusion or some kind of self-awareness on Tony's part, that it's no longer, you can no longer blame your parents, your mother. You cannot go through your life or go through therapy just leaning on that crutch all the time. That after a while, it's you. The problem is you. It's strange. As you were playing that scene, I felt the scene with Melfi. I felt very sorry for Tony Soprano. I actually got choked up. I sort of heard it for the first time, because she's not only saying to him, "This is what you do to other people." But she's saying to him that underneath that, there's this just little scared person who just hates himself. And I felt compassion for the guy.
David Chase, speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2000 interview with David Chase, creator and executive producer of The Sopranos. Terry spoke with him just a few days after the death of Nancy Marchand, the wonderful actress who played Tony's manipulative, miserable, and murderous mother, Livia. Here's a scene from the last episode of the second season, Nancy Marchand's final show. After living in a nursing home against her will, Livia had been taken back to her own home by Tony's sister, Janice, who moved in with her. But Janice had to leave town after killing her fiancé in a rage. Here's Tony and his other sister, Barbara, trying to talk with Livia in her kitchen.
It's some eggplant.
I told you. I'm not hungry.
Now you won't even accept food from your own mother.
Will you please stick to the topic?
Oh, sure, sure. You believe that uncle of yours. I never conspired with him.
I wish somebody would tell me what you're talking about.
Ask your brother.
I'm here to get your living situation settled now with Janice gone. Barbara asked me to come here. Beyond that, I got nothing to say to you.
Ma, you can't come live with us. I'm sorry, but Tom won't allow it.
Janice was right. I won't go back to that place.
You got that right. They won't have you back at Green Grove.
Tony.
She was abusive to the staff.
Maybe Tom and I should just...
No. Don't listen to the manipulation. You got your own life. If you had a mother that had one shred of gratitude in her, one shred, but you don't.
She's taking a page from your wife's book.
Oh, that is outrageous. Come, I'll ask you how many times to come live with us.
Well, he's gone. Nice work, Ma. Carmela's been so sweet to you.
What are you doing?
You're not gonna live with her. There's two tickets. First class. Go to Tucson. Stay with Aunt Gemma. Take Aunt Quinn with you. The other miserable. Done my part. That's all you get from me.
My sister Quintina won't fly.
So throw out in the tarmac.
Now, usually in mafia movies or in gangster movies, the mother is strong and wise and protective of the family. How did you come up with a mother who's so manipulative and bitter and resentful, who even tries to take a hit out on her own son?
Well, to begin with, one is always trying to just to do something different. And certainly the mob genre has been done a bazillion times.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, what could make this different? And I was curious about Mama Corleone. You only saw her sort of stirring some gravy and crying. And I realized that you didn't really have any insight into these women. You did in Goodfellas. Lorraine Bracco played a role that was quite interesting, of Henry Hill's wife. But by and large, the women are lost to the doings of the men. And so that was interesting to me. I thought, and this will maybe be interesting to other people. And so therefore, his mother should be interesting instead of these typical supportive, crying Italian mother.
What did Nancy Marchand bring out in the character? What did you see in her even that led you to decide she's the one?
Well, just how it happened was that we were at the end of the casting process. Almost all the other roles were cast. And there were some difficult roles to cast for this series, but the role of Livia was the worst. Actresses, very gifted actresses, came in, hundreds of them. And by and large, what happened was they would overplay it. It became very big. They played a totally psychotic version, or it just wasn't good, just wasn't there. And we were despairing, and we thought, well, why is it that no one seems to get this? And then the name Nancy Marchand came up, and we thought, well, that could be interesting. And then when she came in, this is just the way it happens always, at least in the way I work. She came in, she read the scene. I was laughing, just laughing out loud. And she was Livia. She understood it completely.
Did your mother have anything in common with Livia, the mother in The Sopranos?
Well, first of all, my mother never tried to have me whacked that I know of.
That's a good thing.
Or never conspired with anyone that I know of. She probably did say, I'd like to kill that kid a couple of times, but not in the same way Livia did. My mother was a very interesting character. She was kind of morbid, very much like Livia, focused on the negative, and kind of in the thrall, by and large, of her own fears and paranoia. It was a little bit hard for my mother to see anything from anyone else's perspective, kind of pretty much like Livia. She was, what loomed largest in my mother's mind always was her view of the world, and it was very hard to shake that view.
Did she make you miserable only to explain that she gave her life for you, making you feel a combination of anger and guilt, like Tony feels?
Yes, she did do that.
Does this mean you couldn't have written the series with this character while she was alive?
I don't know. It's been my experience, in however many years I've been in the TV business, that very often when you base a character on someone, they don't see that. They don't see it themselves in that character.
Interesting.
And that's happened to me a couple of times. Now, it's doubtful that would have happened with my mother, because probably my cousins or somebody would have said, Aunt Norma, it's, you know, it's based on you. They would have done me that favor. So I don't think that would have happened. Could I have done it with her alive? I really don't know. My mother was also a very funny person. I never knew whether it was intentional. Some of it was intentional and some of it was not intentional. But because she was, she always spoke her mind, and because she was always just so into her own preoccupations, that she could be very funny. And I recall that in the early 80s, I did this movie off the Minnesota Strip. And it garnered a lot of attention, and it was played on the air, and it was about a teenage prostitute who tries to reintegrate with her family in her small town world after spending some time on 8th Avenue in New York. She goes back to Minnesota. So it's revealed at the end of the film that the reason, one of the reasons this girl turned out this way, is that her father had sexually molested her when she was very young. And there was, as a writer, what you hope to be, an artful scene in which her mother finally confronts her father about what he had done. And there it's revealed why this child has turned out this way. And my mother was on vacation in Florida, and I called her up to say what she thought of it, and she said, oh, it was good. And I could tell in a way she didn't really get it. And she said she thought that the last scene was about how they had spoiled her, that they had given her too much attention, and that they had and that she was a brat, and that's why she turned out to be a prostitute. So I don't know that my mother would have picked up on this thing with Lydia. I don't know.
I guess you're just too
soft. You never knew what she was going to pick up on.
David Chase speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. His HBO series, The Sopranos, ends Sunday night. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Hardcover, publisher of Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression by Mildred Armstrong Kalish. From the Skoll Foundation, connecting social entrepreneurs around the world with an online community called Social Edge. Learn more at socialedge.org. And from Magnolia Pictures, presenting Crazy Love, the new documentary about romantic obsession from director Dan Cloris, now in theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why the Fox Network turned down The Sopranos. We continue our conversation with David Chase, who created the show. And David Edelstein reviews Ocean's 13.
Bubbles, bangles, hear how they jing-jing-a-ling-a. Bubbles, bangles, bright shiny beads. Sparkles, spangles, her heart will sing-sing-a-ling-a. Wearing baubles, bangles and beads. She'll glitter and gleam so, make somebody dream so, that someday I may buy her a ring, ring a ling. I've heard that's where it leads, wearing baubles, bangles and beads.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli. The HBO series The Sopranos, which premiered in 1999, presents its final episode Sunday. It's written and directed by David Chase, who created the series. Here's a scene from last week's episode, when Tony, Silvio, and Bobby, played by James Gandolfini, Steve Van Zandt, and Steve Sciarrippa, are talking in the Bada Bing. They're planning to hit Phil, the head of the New York mob, before he hits them.
Bird let me know the other night he's been playing both sides of the fence with New York.
Bert?
Measures were taken. Bert wasn't speaking for just himself. Guys are getting squeezed hard to sway them towards new management.
I thought you'd be a part of it.
Then he got an answer. My hope is maybe now Phil gets the message. You know, we can talk to Shrove.
Talk?
Talking about Phil.
We gotta hit first. And this all dovetails with other information I got that this already has a target on my back.
It's a big move.
So, Buddha.
When he stuck you with the tab for Vito Jr., I said let it go. Obviously, truth is, a like Phil, appeasement don't work.
That's how the series is heading to its conclusion. Terry spoke with David Chase in 2000, after The Sopranos had completed its second season.
Writing The Sopranos for HBO means that you can say things and show things that you couldn't do on broadcast TV. So here's some of the things you've done that you wouldn't be able to do on broadcast TV. Using a lot of expletives in the dialogue. You show a couple having sex front to back with the guy holding a gun to the woman's head because the gun turns him on. Disposing of a body by putting it through a meat grinder, although you don't really see anything explicit during that scene. Tony has had food poisoning, and we hear all the sounds that he makes in the toilet. I've never quite heard that on TV. Let's start with the toilet. Why be that graphic with the sounds?
It just seemed real. It just felt that, I mean, I've had food poisoning, and that's the reality of it. And we do try to do things. We try to make things real as much as possible. The reason for doing the food poisoning, that was not an idle choice, like, oh, wouldn't it be funny to have Tony have food poisoning? That came out of a need that I felt, and I hope most of the writers agree with me. I think they did. I didn't want, in other words, pussy's a rat. How's Tony going to find out? I really just didn't want to do some kind of procedural thing in which Tony gets some little clue, and then he send somebody to find out, and then people are trying to get the case on him, and they're reporting back to him, and all that exposition, it bored me terribly. And I just wanted Tony to know on some kind of subconscious level. And the food poisoning, I guess you could say maybe the food poisoning was caused by, if you believe in the mind-body connection, by this overwhelming sense that he had that his friend had betrayed him. Of course, he then did go and get the information he found Pussy's wire. But we didn't have a lot of people talking about it and trying to prove it or anything like that. And so once we made that decision, then we always just try to do realism. It was not the toilet sounds were not a desire to, I mean, they are funny, frankly, I laugh at that stuff, but it was not, that's not the reason we did it. We really just try to make things real. Everything we put in there, we don't put in there for because it's shocking. I mean, the thing about the guy, you know, having sex with his girlfriend from behind, holding the gun to her head. This is something we read in a book about, I forget the name of the book, it was a book about actually mob women in Italy. And it wasn't that we were just trying to be, oh man, look at that. Later on, that gun was going to come back, and that scene was going to come back to haunt that man in a big way.
Right.
It was going to result in his death. Not that that's the reason he got killed, but, you know, you shouldn't hold a gun to somebody's head when you're having sex, I guess. And in the great little karmic universe of The Sopranos, he paid for that.
We know you mentioned you found out about that, a story like that in a book. Where else did you go to find out about mob life? Did you have any, you know, like connected guys who you could call up and ask questions to and who could feed you stories? Or was it through books or just imagination?
Well, it started out I was very interested in this from a very young age. Growing up in New Jersey, I used to read the newspapers, and you know, and fairly regularly during that era, they'd find a Cadillac with a body, you know, shot in the back of a trunk. And this is the Untouchables was on the air, the original Untouchables with Robert Stack, and my dad and I used to watch that all the time, and I loved that show. And so I began immersing myself in this. In mob lore very early on. And so I brought to the show a lot of that. And you know, I have to say right away that the work of Martin Scorsese has been a tremendous influence and obviously a huge pleasure for me to watch ever as long as he's been making films. And so I've consistently gravitated toward it. And so I brought a lot of that with me. And then just, you know, kind of some of it was soaked up from growing up. You know, I'm sorry to say this, but it's the truth. In an Italian-American family in New Jersey, a little bit of it was just soaked up. It's kind of in the air, just a touch. When we actually sat down and did the show, the problem was that what's difficult about it is it's always difficult to... I knew all that stuff from about Longhi's Willman and Johnny DiAguardia, but it's very difficult to find out what's going on in the mob now because no one's going to talk about it. So we did talk to some law enforcement people who were in position to know. And then I don't know how much of this I can actually say. One of our writers on the show, who we missed terribly, did have connections in his hometown to connected guys. And he was able to talk to those guys via telephone and bring back information. So it was really, we got it from as many places as we could.
You were talking about how... interested you were in mob lore when you were growing up. What is the appeal of the mafia? It's been the subject of so many TV shows and movies, and you've been interested in it, you know, all your life. Can you put your finger on what it is?
I just go from thing to thing. I really can't find one sort of unified field theory that covers it. I just know that people just seem to just relate to it in some way. I think it has to do with... I read a quote, I believe it was by John Boorman. He had made this film, The General. It was an Irish about an Irish mobster. He said he believed that in our life today, everything is so bureaucratic, and institutions control and actually comprise so much of our life that there's nothing tribal left anymore. And that a gangster film is a tribal film. And I thought that struck a chord with me. I did believe that.
What's your response to Italian-Americans who get angry that the connection between Italian-Americans and the mob is perpetuated through The Sopranos?
It's true. Mobsters are a very, very small percentage of Italian-Americans. But I don't know what it is with these people, why they never stop and say to themselves, just possibly let this thought into your head, what am I missing here? What is it that so many of my fellow Americans see here and see in a very deep and profound and seemingly endless way? Is it possible that I'm overlooking something? That a lot of my fellow Italian Americans even like. And for whatever reason, I don't understand this, the Italian American gangster story has become a national myth. And why people persist in the kind of, I think, parochial concerns in the face of that, I sometimes want to ask them, are you an Italian-American or are you an American? Because this is an American story.
You initially wrote The Sopranos for broadcast TV for Fox.
Mm-hmm.
And then it got moved to HBO. And again, Fox is broadcast, HBO you can say and show more. How was the story different when it was for broadcast TV?
As I recall, we never said the F word. And that's about it, as far as the pilot script goes. Also, when Fox passed on it, I had the sneaking suspicion that one of the reasons why it happened was that nobody got killed in the pilot episode. And I thought, you know what, that's people want a mob show. These guys want a gangster show. And you didn't kill anybody. And so that's kind of what they wanted. And so when we did the pilot, I thought, well, we need to correct that. Probably someone should get whacked in the pilot episode. But see, I don't really believe that whacking is that endemic to daily. What I want to show is just sort of daily life. And wise guys don't go around whacking people every day. It happens very seldom, and less all the time. So I was trying to do it realistically, and in a way, I guess, I think that kind of hurt the show's chances at a network.
Well, that's funny because...
I know, it's a strange, stupid paradox.
Right, not enough violence, although you couldn't you couldn't use certain language. but the criticism would have been...
No one ever said to me, you know, David, you should have had somebody whacked. I came to that conclusion myself. It was just way too dark for them at Fox. Uh-huh. It was just, it was never going to happen.
David Chase, speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2000 interview with Sopranos creator David Chase.
Now, therapy is so at the center of the series. You know, Tony is in therapy. Were you in therapy a lot?
A lot, yes.
Was your mother a lot of the subject of conversation?
My mother was a fair amount of it, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You said that she was really a worrier, you know, and she was...
She was a very big worrier.
Yeah. Was that contagious? Like, if she was worried that if you did something, you'd be hurt... Did you worry that if you did it, you'd be hurt too? I mean, did it make you a more kind of cautious or
I never thought
inhibited
about that.
Person?
After all those years of therapy, I never thought about that. But I will say that I was a very scaredy kid mm-hmm. when I was little. I was scared. I was afraid of a lot of things. And my cousins knew this. And so they, like my cousin Johnny would, I was about 7 and he was like, I don't know, 10. And he would say, come on, I want to show you something in the garage. They had this creepy old garage, and I'd say, no, you're going to lock me in there. And he'd say, I'm not going to. Come here, you got to come in here and look at this thing. I'd go into the garage, and they'd shut the door and lock me in there. And they could do this, and they was always telling me there were copperheads in the brook when we were rock. They could do this because they knew that I freaked out easily. And I guess that was one of my mother's traits. She also did freak out easily. She was a worrier. And then I think as a teenager later, I became sort of a rebellious, defiant, fast cars and drinking and all that stuff. And I think that was... on my part, an attempt to lose that scaredy kid, to put that, not be that anymore.
Did it work?
Yeah, I think so.
Did you need to leave home to do that?
No, I did not have to leave home. I was very fortunate in that I fell in with a group of friends who my parents thought were really horrible people and didn't want me hanging around with. And as a matter of fact, this group of people, there's been several deaths from heroin. There's been somebody became like a tramp and was run over by a railroad car. I'd have to say that the circle of friends of mine from high school, there's been a lot of tragedy and trouble. In my case, I always feel that those friends showed me another way of being, which is not be terrified all the time. It didn't work out well for some of them. But in my case, I did not perish with it. They also, in a strange way, introduced me to show business. That my friends were interested in. A lot of them were rock and roll musicians, and we had a band and a couple of different bands, and so they were very important in my growing up.
So I'm wondering if those friends who, drove fast cars and did drugs and were much tougher than you were, and kind of introduced you into a new kind of life, if you were able to model anything in The Sopranos. On them, any characters on them or incidents or just a kind of way of living in the world, of not being afraid.
I never thought about this consciously, but as I'm speaking, of course, the conclusions are inescapable that the Soprano crew is a very tight bunch of guys who live life on the edge. My friends and I in New Jersey we were not in any way junior mafiosi or anything like that. We didn't gamble or play the numbers. I mean, there were people in the town who did that stuff. But we were, in context, we were a group of kids in high school who later, probably a year later, after the British invasion,
mm-hmm.
became, I guess you'd say, the first hippies in that town. We crossed over the line from the James Dean thing into the Rolling Stones thing. That's just the time at which we lived. And so we were kind of involved with the Stones and the Beatles before most of the other kids in our town were. We gravitated to that right away. Kids at that time were saying, oh, look at those faggots with long hair. And we just immediately said, wow, that looks cool. Let's do that. We're always looking for, I don't know how you'd express it, just always looking for, I guess, a kind of an outlaw identity.
When you were growing up, were there movies that really scared the heck out of you, but you couldn't take your eyes off of them?
Oh, of course, yes. That's the kind of movies I always liked. As I said, I was a scaredy kid, and yet horror movies and scary movies to me were, I could not get enough of them. And I think I found things to be terrified of in movies that other people didn't. I think a pretty big influence on me was this William Wellman movie, The Public Enemy, mm-hmm. which I saw on Million Dollar Movie when I was probably 8 or 9, and they would play a movie all week long. And in it, there's the gangster Tom Powers is, you know, it's the one where Cagney's finally, after this life of crime. And actually, the mother is very important in that movie, too. He's got this sort of sweet little old Irish mother. But after this horrible life of crime and smashing the grapefruit into that woman's face and everything else that he did, he gets shot and he says, I ain't so tough, and he collapses on his knees. But at the end of the movie, he's in a hospital and the rival gangs calls his mother's house and says, we're sending Tom home. And his brother runs up the stairs and says, Ma, they're bringing Tom home. And she puts on this I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles record and it's playing and she's making the bed and she's sort of singing and feathers are going every place. She's happy and his brother's all excited. He's coming home and then there's a knock on the door and the brother opens the door and you see Cagney's wrapped up in a blanket with his head all in bandages from the hospital tied up like a mummy and he's dead and he's dead eyes and he just sort of topples toward camera right into the lens. That's the end of the movie. This was the most frightening thing I'd ever seen. I was scared about this for a month. I could not get that out of my mind.
What was it that was so scary?
I don't know to this day. This the idea, those people's expectations in the house, it's actually making me kind of sad. I don't know, their expectations of what was going to happen and what really did happen, that they were so happy that he was coming home and he was dead in such a horrible way and how he'd wasted his life.
Right. Do you ever hear from people who are in the mob and watch the series and comment one way or another?
No, not directly. There are people who work on the show in New York who know people who know people who know people. Mm-hmm. And the word has filtered back through that pipeline that the first season what we heard was they just were okay. That's all we ever heard. We're okay. But then recently in the New York metropolitan area, stories were printed about a Jersey crime family who FBI transcripts came out in which they talked about the Sopranos and they felt that the Sopranos was based on them, which it isn't. I want to be quick to assure them. No, it is not at all. I mean, we make up a lot of this stuff and it's interesting that it happens to coincide with what they feel is real life. And actually, I mean, in terms of from a realistic standpoint, I have to take that. I'm glad that we're getting something right about that life because, as I said, it's impossible to penetrate.
Well, David Chase, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It's been really great.
David Chase, creator of The Sopranos, speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. The final episode of the series, which airs Sunday on HBO, is both written and directed by David Chase. Coming up, David Edelstein on Ocean's 13. This is Fresh Air. The Rat Pack is back. No, not Frank, Dean, and Sammy, but George Clooney, Brad Pitt, and Matt Damon in Ocean's 13. Clooney plays Danny Ocean in the third of the series of films directed by Steven Soderbergh. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Ocean's 13 is the newest collaboration between Steven Soderbergh and George Clooney, and it's great fun. It's also fascinating to think about in relation to their last project, the misbegotten The Good German. There, Soderbergh set out to make the anti-Casablanca, but in the glossy, glamorous, old movie style of Casablanca, he wanted to expose the corruption the glamour concealed that existed in Germany in the wake of the greatest generation's greatest victory. The film, possibly inspired by Soderbergh and Clooney's despair over Iraq, came off as heartless and cheap, but it was remarkably consistent with the body of Soderbergh's work. He shoots his own films under the name Peter Andrews, and since his debut, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, he has probed the unreliability of surfaces. The bigger the sheen, the bigger the lie. So what does this have to do with Ocean's 13, the second sequel in a franchise that began as a remake, set in swank Las Vegas, with stars getting huge paychecks for hamming it up in expensive suits? Well, it's all and only surface, a big, gorgeous lie. The movie glides in on a wave of hipsterism, on Vegas-y jazz, and A-list leading men who saunter across the color-saturated screen. There are no visual or moral dissonances. Our twinkling thieves, led by Danny Ocean, played by Clooney, aren't in this one for the money. They're out to avenge their friend and elder, Reuben, played by Elliot Gould, who goes into a catatonic state after being muscled out of a deal by casino magnate Willie Bank, played by Al Pacino. After consulting with his posse, including Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Don Cheadle, and others, Ocean decides to give Bank a second chance before bringing him down. They call this a Billy Martin for the alcoholic Yankees manager who kept getting fired and rehired until he finally ran his car into a tree.
Some guys I take seriously told me you're a serious guy.
Good. What I want, what's most important to me, is that Reuben gets his share of the hotel restored. Now, I'm here to give you a chance to do that.
Oh, you're going
to
give me a chance? Okay. So, Billy Martin, I pass. The last time I looked, and I look every morning, it was my name listed as owner on more valuable property in this state than anyone else in history.
Which means you got a lot more to lose.
Well, I don't lose. People who bet on me to lose, lose, and they lose big. You come at me, you better know. I move quick, and when I do, I slice.
So you're not going to make Reuben whole?
If Reuben was too weak or too stupid to see what was coming down, then you know what? He doesn't belong here. He's made the right choice. Roll over and die. Let him be.
Pacino has a good time flashing his choppers under a curly henna thatch of hair, setting his character up for the fall you know will come. Ocean and his team must prove mightier than this pop top. They're masters of the con as the smooth, multifaceted machine. They even managed to bring on board Ocean's previous archenemy, casino owner Terry Benedict, played by Andy Garcia. He resents Pacino's new place for throwing a shadow over his swimming pool. It's a good move for the movie, too. Garcia has never looked so sleek and sharp and dangerously pleased with himself. The previous sequel, Ocean's 12, had an excellent comic subplot with Julia Roberts, but was otherwise all over the place. This one, without Roberts or any love interest, is as elegant and streamlined as its hero. The movie's interlocking scams and triple crosses aren't always easy to follow, but Soderbergh is a savvy guy. As the plotting gets knottier, his technique gets more fluid, the editing jazzier, the colors more luscious, the whip pans more whiz-bang. It's all anchored by Clooney, looking impudent, roguish, laughably handsome. The character, the whole movie, seems to emanate from his well-known real-life penchant for practical jokes. Ocean's 13 is such an exhilarating ride. It made me wonder if Soderbergh, after deconstructing every lustrous image in The Good German, was liberated by making a con artist comedy in Vegas. The city, after all, is a monument to con artistry. Every surface is a lie. Ocean's 13 has so many layers of deception, it's practically deep. It's like the famous cosmology joke about turtles. It's lying surfaces all the way down.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
You do something to me.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
That voodoo that you do so well, 'cause you do something to me nobody else could do.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Histories of Herodotus, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from Magnolia Pictures, presenting Crazy Love, the new documentary about romantic obsession from director Dan Cloris, now in theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Rock en Español. Los Straitjackets and Big Sandy are on tour, and they stop by the Fresh Air studios for a concert and conversation. Join us for the next Fresh Air. Solitarias. Llore el ojo.